morning.
So, as I've already told you in both the previous lectures, tutorials for this course are going to start in week 3, which is next week. And the way the course is going to operate for tutorials is that exercises will be released 1 week in advance of tutorials. So tutorials are going to be held Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. So that means the first exercise is going to be released today. For this tutorial only, for the first tutorial, we will email an announcement about the release of the tutorial. The tutorial will be placed on the web page, and a blog entry will be made about the tutorial. In future weeks, there will be no email, but there will be a blog entry about the release of the tutorial, and a tutorial will be placed on the course web page. So in future weeks, you need to keep in touch with the course web page and look at the course blog. And hopefully you've all checked your tutorial groups by now. If you still haven't, please do that. And as I said before, if there's any problem in attending your allocated tutorial group, please contact the Informatics Teaching Office, that's the ITO, at level 4 of this building, and they will arrange a swap for you with another tutorial group. Right, the other thing to say is about the handouts. In the last lecture, for those of you who missed it, there were two handouts. One was a chapter from the Database Management Systems book, which is, in a sense, the course text for this part of the book, although you can perfectly well get by without buying this course text. And the other handout was a copy of the lecture slides. Today, again, there's a handout which is a copy of the lecture slides, and if you haven't collected a copy on your way in, please do that now, because we'll be making notes as we go along. If you missed any of the handouts from the previous lectures, they, like all handouts for future lectures, spare copies are available of them outside room 5.03 on level 5 of Appleton of this building. So that's the level just above the Informatics Teaching Office. Okay, so last time we didn't quite finish the lecture slides, but that gives me a convenient excuse for reminding you where we got to and what we covered in the last lecture. So you'll remember the main content of the last lecture was introducing these entity relationship diagrams, which were diagrams for expressing the structure that you're going to want your database to possess, and for putting constraints on it. So the kind of things that were introduced were this notation for the diagram, where you had boxes for what were called entity sets. There were ovals, none of which are appearing in this diagram, although each of the entity sets has a number of ovals associated with it. Those were the attributes that represented the fields of information that we contain about, that we have about students in this case. There were diamonds that represented relationships between different entity sets. So here the relationship is the directed by relationship that says, relates a student to a director of studies, saying that a particular student is related to, well, is directed by a particular director of studies. And then there were constraints that we were putting on these entity sets and relationships in the forms of various notation. So here, this is a bold arrow, and this expressed a key plus a participation constraint. The key constraint said that every student has at most one director of studies, and the participation constraint said that every student belongs to this relationship. So put together, that means that every student has exactly one director of studies. Now, after the lecture last time, somebody came up to me and asked me a very good question. They said, why do we want to put these constraints on the diagram? And the reason is this, that what we're doing in drawing these diagrams, and the tutorial exercise for next week will be an example of a scenario where we want to capture aspects of the scenario in one of these entity relationship diagrams. What we're doing is we're formulating the structure of the scenario that we're trying to model, in this case, a database of students, their courses, their directors of studies, and other information relevant to the university. And these constraints represent real constraints in the world that we know to hold. So in this case, the constraint is, we know it to be the case that in this university, every student has exactly one director of studies. So we can put this constraint on the diagram to reflect that. But what use is doing that? Well, the point of it is that but we're expressing properties of the structure of the system that eventually we want to translate this, and this is what we're going to actually do later in today's lecture, translate this to a more realistic, something closer to the implementation of a database model. And these constraints will affect how we translate the diagram into the model. So the fact that we know that every student has exactly one director of studies, that's going to help us translate the diagram into an efficient database that really implements the situation we've got. So it's important to have that information available. And the other thing on this slide is, notice the notation here with the dots. Well, these dots represent individual students. They're all flagged by their primary keys, which are their matriculation numbers. These dots represent the DOSes, flagged by their staff identity numbers. And these lines represent which students are related to which DOS in this diagram. So we see here that there's no total participation here because there's one director of studies who's on sabbatical and so doesn't have any students being directed by him for them at the moment. And each student indeed satisfies the constraint that they have exactly one director of studies that directs them. Okay, so that takes us up to date, and we now want to just consider two more different components that one might introduce in entity relationship diagrams because they're useful for modeling aspects of the world. So one of them is what's called a weak entity set, and this, the idea here is that we're implementing something. So in this case, the entity set we're looking at is the entity set of rooms in a building, and again we have the attributes, those are the ovals associated with the entity set, and these represent the information we want to store about a room. So we put here the room number, which is going to uniquely identify the room, and other useful, so here the room number for this lecture theatre would be LT3, for example, lecture theatre 3, and the capacity, how many people will fit in the room, is also useful information we want to store. Of course, the number itself doesn't identify the room unless we know what building it's in. There might be many other buildings that have a lecture theatre 3 in that's given the number LT3. So we could, in order to identify a primary key, we could also put a building attribute here and have the room with the building, and then we would put number and building as the key. We would identify that as the primary key of the room. But that might not be the most useful thing to do because we don't want necessarily to have buildings just referred to as the places that rooms are. We might want other information about buildings in the database. So it might be useful, and in fact, in the database on the slides, that's what we're doing, to have a separate entity set about buildings, storing the information we want to have about buildings. Because we're not only interested in buildings in respect to the rooms that are inside them. We're interested also in buildings in their own right. So here we have an entity set for buildings, which has the name of the building, which is the, we're having that as the primary key. So in the university, no two buildings are going to have the same name. We'll make sure that when we have a new building, we're not going to name it with the same name as another building. And the address is, well, that would also identify it, but here we're choosing the name as the primary key. But this is the sort of information we might have associated with a building. So now for a room, we of course want to say that a room is in a building, but the place to have the building is not as an attribute for the room anymore because we need the buildings to refer to our information about buildings to be connected to the information we've got about the buildings in the database. So instead of that, we have a relationship relating them, saying that a room is located in a building. And of course, a room will satisfy this key plus participation constraint. It's many to one. Each room has exactly one building that it's in, although each building may have several rooms in it. And it satisfies a participation constraint that every room must be in some building. So it has this bold arrow associated to it saying, from every room we can find the unique building it's associated with. And now we form what's called a weak entity set, where we take, because we've got this key plus participation constraint, we can take the number of the room together with the primary key for the building, together with the name of the building, as the primary key of the room. So that's what we're choosing for the key for the room. So the idea of a weak entity set is the attributes of the room itself do not suffice to identify the room, but we inherit those attributes from, but we inherit some other keys from a referenced entity set, here the case of building, here the entity set of buildings, and we combine the primary key of the buildings with the extra information we need, in this case the room number, in order to give a primary key to the room. So that's the notation there. You see that to emphasize that we've got a weak entity set, we put a double border around the rectangle here. We put a double underline for the attributes of the weak entity set that are forming part of the new primary key. They're only part of it because the rest of the key is the primary key from the building. And this is called the identifying relationship, this, because it relates the weak entity set to the strong entity set that it's part of. Okay, so here's the definition, but I'll just leave that on the slide. We don't really need to talk through that now because I've already gone over all aspects of it in what I've said. Right, so it's just one more component that we're going to have in our entity relationship diagrams, and this is a useful one for isolating some subclasses of entity sets and saying, well, some subclasses have additional properties that we might want to talk about. So an example of that is students. Well, we might want to distinguish, so the information we've given ourselves about students, their matriculation number, MN, the name and the email, with the matriculation number as the primary key. But we might want to separate the students into those that are full-time and those that are part-time, because we're going to deal with them differently in terms of, for example, how we allocate courses, the number of courses we allocate to a student. So here we're doing that by saying, well, part-time students and full-time students are two different sub-entity sets, they're called subclasses of the entity set of students. And this triangle, this ISA, is saying every full-time student is a student and every part-time student is a student. And notice that, so the notation here, I'm going to do more work on the blackboard later that I'll put the blackboard up for, but this is just a small point, so I'm not going to bother to put the lights on. I think you'll be able to see it anyway. So the important thing here in the use of ISA, you have a triangle and you have one entity set connected off the top, and you might have several entity sets connected off the bottom or other parts of the triangle. And the one that's connected to the top vertex, this is the superclass. So here the class, the entity set of all students. And the one that's connected to the bottom, those are the subclasses. So that's the general notation that you can't completely infer just from this picture, which just has the two subclasses. But the important thing about these subclasses, why do we say, well, they belong to the students? Well, they inherit, we don't need to draw them on the diagram, they automatically inherit all the attributes of the student. So every full-time student has a matriculation number, a name, and an email, and every part-time student has a matriculation number and a name and an email. But the reason for separating things in this way, well, we might want the information that the students are full-time students or part-time students, but we also might have additional information that we want to store about one of the subclasses of students. So in this case, we've got here a part-time fraction saying this student is a one-third of a full-time student, so they're going to take their courses in three times the length of time that a full-time student would take, or say a half part-time student, that means they take the courses in twice the length of time that an ordinary student would take. Right, okay, so that's everything about entity relationship diagrams. Are there any questions on that before we move on to the next part of the course? So, So the main thing today is going to be to introduce, you'll remember last time I talked about the design process of a database, and the entity relationship diagram sat in between the real world situation we're trying to model and the eventual implementation of the database at the bottom. We're now going to look at a model which is much closer to the implementation, and the goal of today's lecture, the ultimate goal, is going to be then to understand this model and then to translate the entity relationship diagram pretty much automatically into the more real-world model. The real-world model is close to the implementation of a database. And this real-world model is called the relational model. Now, this is a very important concept. It was proposed in 1970 by a British computer scientist, in fact, called Edgar Codd, who was working in America and at IBM. And he had a very nice paper about this in which he said, well, this is a very neat idea. We can store data in this very simple way as relations. And then it was a theoretical paper. He proposed it as a theoretical model, and he said, well, we have these two nice languages for talking about data stored in this way. One, a kind of logic, and another one, a sort of calculus that we can use for querying the database. Both of these we're going to meet in future lectures. And in fact, they're equivalent, and that means that on the one hand, because of the logic, we can think of our data in what's called a declarative way. We'll query our database and we'll think about what kind of information we want to extract, but not how to extract it. But the equivalence means we have an automatic way of going from what we want to extract into what's called a procedural way of obtaining the data, that is, a method for abstracting it. But still, it was considered a very, very theoretical paper at the time that it was released in 1970, and wasn't taken very seriously by his employers, that were IBM. So he was employed by IBM, and he proposed this idea, and people didn't seem so very interested in it. But other people realized that this is a very simple idea that at the same time is a very powerful data model, and they started to implement a database language that eventually became called SQL and is now SQL, which is the most commonly used database language, that was based on this idea. And the idea really flew from there. And this is now, as I say here, relational databases are a multi-billion pound industry. So we had what was being proposed originally as a theoretical idea being very quickly developed into something extremely successful and practical. And I think a major reason for this is the simplicity of the model. And hopefully in the lecture today, I will try to bring out a little bit the simplicity of the model. Hopefully it's not going to look really too complicated, but we shall see about that. But before I go on, I just want to mention, and actually I'd written down the information on a sheet of paper to bring in, but I forgot to bring it in. But I want to mention that for people who are interested in somehow this idea of a theoretical idea being then turning out to be very powerful in practice and turning into something that's now a multi-billion pound industry, there was a very nice inaugural lecture given by a professor at the School of Informatics last year that's available on YouTube online, and you might like to look at it. It's specifically about relational databases. So it's by Professor Leonid Lipkin. So inaugural lecture on YouTube. Unfortunately, the information I forgot to bring is the title of the lecture, but this should be enough to find it online. And one nice thing, at the end of the lecture, there's a question and answer session, and that largely concerns Codd's discovery of relational databases and to what extent it was a theoretical idea and a practical idea and how that took off. So if you look at the lecture and you find that it's getting a bit long, you might skip to the end and have a look at the question and answer session. The last thing to say about Codd is that he won the 1981 Turing Award for this pioneering work. So who knows what the Turing Award is? Does anyone know? Yes? Yes? Yeah. Yeah, okay, you. Yeah, so it's kind of the computer science version. There is no Nobel Prize in computer science because when Alfred Nobel was alive, there weren't any computers. But there is a major prize. Well, there are several major prizes in computer science, but the one that's got the highest prestige is the Turing Award. And so Codd was awarded this most prestigious prize in computer science for his work. And I shall talk a little bit more about the Turing Award as a sort of interval in the lecture later on at an appropriate point to pause. But let's now go into the relational model. And as I said, one of the main features of the relational model is that it's very simple. But when you look at this slide, it doesn't seem simple because there's rather a lot of terminology here. So the basic constructs are a relation, which consists of a schema and an instance. And a schema is the format of the relation, and a relation instance is also known as a table. And so actually there's not only a lot of terminology, but there's a lot of terminology that has two different ways of saying the same thing. So relation, instance, and table, and domains are also referred to as types, and so on. So it looks like quite a lot to take in. So it's much better to have a look at a picture and see what all this refers to. So a relation consists of a schema together with an instance. So the schema is just the format. So here we have a relation instance, in fact, of a table for students, so that it relates to what we've been doing hitherto in the course. So the schema is saying how many different attributes, essentially, the students have. And these are called fields or columns in database terminology. So here, so the schema says we have a matriculation number, a name, an age, and an email. So it's just like the attributes that we have in the entity relationship diagram associated with students. The relation instance is the data that we have populating this relation. And it's also called a table because you naturally write it in a table form like this. So here we have the relation instance consisting of these four students, John, Mary, Helen, and Peter, together with all the information about them. Each row is called either a record or a row in the table or a tuple, because you can also write the information. Tuples mean information given inside brackets in an ordered way, so we could also write it S04 dot dot dot, comma John. So I'm just saying the dot dot dot, just not to waste time writing it here. 18 John at inf. So that would be one way of giving the notation for a row. And that's the way we're actually going to use in SQL. So the tuples are the rows, and the table has an arity, that's a size, and that's the arity is the number of rows in the table. Sorry, the cardinality. That's the cardinality, yes. The arity is rather the number of columns in the table. Sorry for getting muddled up there. Anyway, that is all the information in a nice picture. So basically, tables are these nice square tables that we can look at and think of visually. So it is a simple model in terms of how we can visualize how the data appears in the relational model. And as I said, Codd's paper introduced two different ways of talking about relational data, this one way based on logic and another way based on something he called relational algebra, both of which we're going to discuss in forthcoming lectures in the course. But nowadays one uses a professionally designed query language that's based on these ideas called SQL. So I'm actually going to introduce the relational model using SQL a little bit to define the kinds of tables we're going to look at and the way we're going to manipulate tables in the relational model. So SQL is now, as many of you know, the standard language for interacting with relational databases. And I won't go through this in too much detail because we're going to cover SQL in more detail in a later lecture. But what we're going to do today in SQL is just consider what's called the data definition language, which is a very basic component of SQL, which allows you to define the schemas for relations. So remember, the schema was the names and of the fields, and also, in fact, actually the thing I didn't cover on this diagram was the domains, which saying that this is a string, this is a string, this, the information here is an integer, and this is again a string. So the schema allows you to give that sort of information. And we're going to consider the language of SQL that allows us to define this part of the table. Okay, so in SQL, relations are called tables, so we will explicitly refer to them normally as tables. And it's a typed language because we're going to define schemas. So we're going to say student has these attributes associated with it. These are called fields, matriculation number, and so on. And we're going to give each one a type. That's the domain, saying, for example, matriculation number is a string or a number, depending on how you want to represent it. And there's also a special null value that you can use at any type, which we're going to look at later. So the general thing we want to say, what we're going to come to eventually, is translating our entity relationship diagram into an SQL-defined set of schema defined in SQL that implements the relationships we've got and also hopefully enforces the constraints that we've put in the entity relationship model. So to do this, we need a general way of defining a schema. And this is done in the following form using create table. So we're creating a table for students. And here's an example here. So we create the table students. And, well, we just want to say what the attributes are. So the attributes are called fields or columns in SQL. So the matriculation number. So actually we're representing this as a character string with 8 numbers. That allows us to put the S in front of the matriculation number with eight characters. Name, we're giving 20 characters for the name. Not very generous, but anyway, probably sufficient. Age, an integer. Email, here a string of 15 letters, hopefully sufficient. And this isn't necessarily the best designed database. One might actually lengthen these strings if one was really implementing such a thing. And then, just as we did with the entity relationship diagram, we identified a primary key. So we know what the notion of key is from the last lecture. We need to identify one as the primary key we're going to use. So here we're identifying, just as we had in our ER diagram before, primary key is the matriculation number. And up here, we've got the general form of the data definition language statement. So the way to read this thing, if you haven't seen these before, this is just giving ourselves a format for being able to write these such declarations in the data definition language. What it says is, the general form is we say create table, and then we give the name of the table. We then open some brackets, which we'll eventually close at the end. And then what we need to do is we need to declare the fields of the table. That means we need to give a field name, an attribute name, followed by its type. So here, matriculation number and string of characters, 8 in length. And then following this, well, this stuff with a star in, this is a regular expression, as you will have met in the first term course on computational logic. So this is saying we can follow this by any number of attribute names together with types, separated by commas, and then at the end we put some integrity constraints. So here the integrity constraint is saying that matriculation number is the primary key. That's called an integrity constraint. But I think just the simple format here is very transparent, and we're just easily translating what was in the entity relationship diagram into this SQL format. Okay, and here this is explained, but I've already gone through the explanation. Maybe one thing to say is it's important that that when you declare the table, you must only have one row So the important thing is to explain is the primary key constraint. So the primary key constraint is saying that the matriculation number is the primary key. Now, as you'll remember from the last lecture, the notion of a key, so a key has this important definition that a key needs to uniquely determine the entry associated with the key. That's the crucial property. And SQL will enforce this. So the key constraints, the constraints we put on the data, SQL enforces them. So that means when we've got a table like this, if we try to put in a second student with the same matriculation number as a student who's already present in the table, SQL will complain and it will say, you can't do that, you're violating the primary key constraint. And that's what we want to do in order to maintain the correctness of the data that we're storing. We don't want to be allowed to erroneously put in two different students with the same matriculation number. So it's good, this is how these kind of constraints that we have in the model actually help us in with the implementation. So here's another example of a relationship. So here we're implementing the takes relationship. So remember, the takes relationship was relating a student to a course they were taking, so students to the courses they take. So here we need to have a reference for the student, so we give the primary key for the student. We need to have a reference for the course, so we give the code for the course. And there was also, if you remember from the last lecture, associated with the takes relationship, there was also another attribute, which is the mark for the course. So we're putting that in as a field with an integer. And now the primary key for the relationship is the student together with the code, because in order to determine an instance of the takes relationship, well, we need both the student and the course, because neither one of them on its own will determine the instance, will be enough to get us the mark. But we also need to relate the matriculation number to say, well, this actually refers to something in the student's table, and also the code to say that this refers to something in the course's table. So now we put on what are called foreign key constraints, saying the information about the matriculation number is referring to a student for which we can find all other information about them in the student's table. And similarly, the code entry here is referring to an entry in the courses table for which we can extract other information about them there. Okay, so that's the basic idea. There's just one note to make about this. So foreign key constraints. So this is when we're saying that the matriculation number is referring to a student in the student's table. So foreign key constraints, the important restriction is that the field, or fields, as we'll see later, the fields declared as a foreign key must have the same type as the primary key, in the referenced table. So what this means, when we say foreign key MN matriculation number references students, in order for SQL to accept this, the type, which is a character string of length 8 here, must match the type of the primary key in the student's table. So we look back at the student's table, so SQL will do this, we'll look back at the student's table, and it checks the type of the matriculation number here, and this is a character string of 8, so that is the same type, so that's okay. There's another thing that's misleading in this example, that here we have used the same field name, MN, here, as we used in the students' table. You don't need to do that. The only important thing in SQL is that the types match. So we could have just as well written create table takes and then given a different field name like matric char 8. So we need to give it, the important thing is to give it the same type information, and then everything the same as before, but using matric in the two places that MN appears here. So the actual field names you give are local to the schema that you're using. The important thing is when you refer across tables that the types match. And this is a very important thing because sometimes you need to use the same field, you need to use two different field names referencing the same table in the same, referencing the same foreign key in the same table. We'll see examples of that later in the course. But just, this is the important point here, that the field types must be the same, but you don't need to have the same field name. Yes?
How would it know which field to get from students then if you change the name in the table?
Right, good question. So how does it know which field to get from students? Well, it references the one that you have declared to be the primary key. So in the students, and in every table, you're declaring something to be the primary key. So you have to match the primary key here, and it links it to that key. Any other questions? Yes? Right, so if you have a key that consists of two attributes, you would say, we don't have an example, well, you would just say foreign key. If it were a primary key in a different table, you would say foreign key MN, comma code, for example. So you just use this tuple notation. We'll see examples of that elsewhere in the course. So that's a good question, but can't really give the example at the moment. Okay, so this just explains that example. And let's see how that works in a picture. So here we have the example of the takes relation. And we see that the matriculation number is taken from the students table, and the course code is taken from the course table. And the other thing to say then is that how these are used in SQL, so again, the point of these constraints is to make sure that the data we put into the database is correct. So it must satisfy these constraints. And SQL does that in this case by when we put a new entry into the takes table, then SQL checks that the value we put in for the matriculation number in this takes relation really does correspond to a student that exists in the student table. We're not allowed to put in something that doesn't correspond to a student that exists in the student table that's already there. And in the same way, the value we put in for the code field of the course they take must correspond to a genuine course that is already in the course table. Okay? So here we see everything is, all the constraints are satisfied. The primary keys are unique identifiers here, and the matriculation numbers all appear in the students, and the codes all appear in the course table. Okay, so that's the idea of the relational model. It may still seem quite complicated at the moment. I think the best thing to do, I think I've basically been over the summary. So it may seem quite complicated. I hope that it's going to seem a bit simpler when we now consider the main point of the lecture, which is going to be to translate automatically from an entity relationship diagram into a schema in a set of schemas in SQL. But before doing that, in order to somehow let the ideas settle in the background, I thought, I would put a slight pause in the lecture and consider a little bit more about the Turing Award. So the Turing Award seems a good point to mention this, because Codd's work on relational databases was lauded with the award of the most prestigious prize in computer science, the Turing Award. So as somebody said, the Turing Award is essentially the equivalent of the Nobel Prize in computer science, as it's awarded annually by the Association for Computing Machinery, which is the main American academic body for computer science. And it actually has quite a sizable award associated with it. So it's now sponsored by Google, and it has £250,000 coming with it. So it's well worth aspiring to win a Turing Award, if something to aspire to. Anyway, so Codd is one recipient of a Turing Award. I wonder, does anybody know anybody of any other scientists that have won the Turing Award? So just... this is sort of general computer science education, yes?
Turing himself.
Turing himself? Yeah. Well, actually, Turing died in the 1950s. So Alan Turing was a founder of the notion of computability and one of the fathers of the idea of artificial intelligence. He's being celebrated this year because it's his centenary. It's 100 years since his birth. The Turing Award was, as an important founding father of computer science and artificial intelligence, the Turing Award was named in his honor, but it was instigated several years after Turing's death. So no, just as Nobel didn't win the Nobel Prize, Turing didn't win the Turing Award. So, yes? Dijkstra. So let's have a look. Let's have a look at the... here we are, chronological listing of... Here we have all... It doesn't quite fit on, but... So here are all award winners. Edgar Dijkstra in 1972, do you know what he did? Okay, so I don't really know what Edgar Dijkstra did either, but he did some clever algorithms about graphs, for example, how to manipulate data structures. And so anyway, there are many people here, I don't know what they did. So let's have a look at some of the Turing Award winners. And so this is just a sort of interlude, general knowledge interlude in the lecture. So, two people I'd like to single out are Leslie Valiant, who's the most recent recipient on this website, even though 2010 was 2 years ago. So, actually, I don't know who got the 2011 award. Leslie Valiant and Robin Milner, and the reason I'm singling them out is that they were both lecturers, and in Robin Milner's case, a professor at the University of Edinburgh. Some years ago. So Robin Milner was in Edinburgh until 1995. Sadly, he died last year. Leslie Valiant was in Edinburgh in the 1970s at the start of his career as a lecturer, but he did some of his most important work while he was here at Edinburgh. In fact, that some of the work on computer learning that he was cited for in the Turing Award. So maybe one other person to single out is Stephen Cook, where's Stephen Cook? I think he must be off the screen. Does anyone know what Stephen Cook did? Does anyone know what Stephen Cook did? So he formulated a very famous problem, which is whether something called P equals something called NP, which is basically a problem about how hard it is to decide if a propositional formula in logic of the kind you considered in computational logic course is satisfiable. And this is a very famous problem because it now has an $1 million prize associated with its solution. So if anyone is able to decide whether that is actually very... People think that it's impossible to compute this problem efficiently, but if anyone's able to prove that's the case, they will be awarded £1 million. So this is, $1 million, US dollars. So this has stimulated a lot of research in computer science. And one other one to mention is, the problem is this, I've just realized this mouse is doing some funny things. But so another one to mention is at the bottom there, Edelman, Rivest, and Shamir. Do anyone know what they did? Sorry? Somebody said the right thing. Yes? Not quite. Somebody else said it. It was RSA, in fact. So their initials are RSNA, and they're the people that came up with the very famous RSA encryption algorithm that is used whenever you make... This is the basis of security of online... basically, all secure purchases you make online nowadays. So that was... a very important contribution. Okay, well, that was like an interruption to the lecture that was supposed to be in the middle of the lecture, but amazingly, we seem to have reached the end of the time. So that you can think of that as you've got until Friday for this material to sink in, and then we'll see the translation from the entity relationship model on Friday.
But we can change the local name.
Yeah.
We can change it to matrix. Should we change it here and
here? Yeah, you need to change it everywhere in this table. Yeah.
But how, if we change it here, how it will find the reference column in students?
Well, that's what I said. Somebody asked that question because it automatically links it to the primary key of the student's table, which you've declared in the student's table. So in the student's table, you say primary key MN.
Yeah, but if the primary key is actually two attributes and both have char 8.
Well, here the primary key is one attribute. You have to match the type of the primary key. So if it were two attributes here, then you would have to give two attributes here and they would be matched. They would both be matched.
And if two were with the same type, how would you figure out which to which?
But because they're written in an order, so you put them in brackets and they're written, so the first one goes with the first one, the second one goes with the second one. So, yeah. Yeah, hi.
Will this be posted on WebCT?
Sorry?
The things for the tutorial?
It's not going to be on WebCT, it's going to be on the course webpage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm not on the WebCT for this class.
There isn't a WebCT for this class. No, you need to go off the course webpage, which is linked from the informatics first year students webpage.
Okay.
Yeah.
And,
so if you search on Google for informatics one data and analysis, you'll see that.
Okay.
Sorry, what was the other question? Okay.
Oh yeah, where do you pick up the
Hi, Stuart.
The for the old
from outside So from the fifth floor here outside room 5.03.
Okay.
They're in the old handouts. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, bother. What have you got there? What have you got there?
So for a testing.
Uh-huh. Were you here last week?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I was. I was probably a bit late.
I believe that's why it's Tuesday, it's 12 o'clock. It must be software testing. This is you. Yeah?
Yes, thank you.
Totally good.
Are you signing professorial roles?
Yeah, I am signing professor. Are you going to be there as well?
I was away last week.
Ah, oh, okay. Yeah, I've got to do that. I'm also supposed to be at College Learning and Teaching Committee. I don't know how long signing the professorial role takes. Is it very formal?
Well, I guess the actual process doesn't take very long.
No, but I think... Yeah.
I'm sure there's going to be all quills or something.
Well, apparently it has to go off to the calligrapher. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The actual entry
has
to be done calligraphically.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you just sort of trace it.
No, then you sign. Yeah, so there's the entry on the roll, and then you sign the entry on the roll. So I don't know whether you're given a cold pen to do it, yeah?
See
yeah. What, is it 3 o'clock?
Sorry?
Is it 3 o'clock?
Yeah.
Well, where is it?
The
and it's in the Rayburn room. Oh, my God.
Which one is the Rayburn?
It's, you know, if you go past, you know, you come in and go